Jesh is at heart a thinker, a man who has spent much of his life asking the big questions, the ones that help make sense of who we are and why we're here. Over the years, traveling the planet, immersing himself in the conversations that change things, he has become a very successful professional photographer who's also a retreat leader, a business coach, and a joy researcher. His work has been featured in Vogue, Huffington Post, Elle, Rangefinder, just to name a few. He's worked for celebrities and high-end clients all over the world, and he's figured out how to start and grow a creative business based entirely in joy and personal growth. Hi, I'm Daphne Cohn, founder of the Creativity Circles Collective, and you're listening to the Creativity Habit Podcast, the practice behind the art, the story behind the artist. Today's guest is photographer, entrepreneur, and joy researcher, Jesh Darox. In this conversation, we talk about how to overcome the biggest hurdles to creating and living a meaningful life, the most unusual and powerful business building and life advice you'll ever get, and it's targeted specifically at artists and makers. What you must know to create what is most honestly yours, and why what we see on Instagram is not what we want to imitate in art or life. Now, after every conversation, I spend a few hours editing and prepping the interview to go live. In listening back over this conversation, I took over 4 single-spaced type pages of notes. I have thought over things he shared countless times since this conversation, and I've also shared pieces of it with numerous friends and family. This is one episode not to be missed. May it inspire you to make your thing and change your world. Hello, Jesh, and welcome to the Creativity Habit Podcast.
Thank you very much.
I typically begin with how creativity showed up for you as a child, and I want to gear it a little more specifically also to the creative way in which your childhood was fashioned for you, because you did not have a typical childhood. So can you begin by speaking to both how creativity showed up for you, but within this very different childhood that you had?
Yeah, sure. I grew up as a part of a family of my mother and father, I guess, who were seekers. And my dad had gone through university and, you know, was going to be enrolled in the military like his father was. And he just, something in him decided there had to be more, you know, to life than what he had been told. And he dropped out and he was going to go travel the world until he found a spiritual teacher, you know, which was kind of an in vogue thing to do back then. And he was, you know, prepared to go all the way to India, which is like, you know, the famous hotspot for spiritual teachers, especially at that time. But he ended up finding, you know, somebody a lot closer to his home. It was a man that just was kind of in touch with things that are underneath what we call life in the world and stuff. And it just really spoke to my dad strongly. And so he just decided to go on the adventure that this guy was going on. And he was a non-denominational Christian kind of group, but they believed something that was very controversial, especially in the Christian world, which is something called continual revelation. And that basically means that, you know, for an infinite God, there's an infinite amount of things to learn, to see, and to explore, versus here are the 3 things that you need to know, and these are the only 3 things, and they were said 2,000 years ago, and that's the end of the story. So really, even based in the way that I was taught about, you know, religion and spirituality and life in general, from the very root of it, I was super lucky to be, you know, in the vicinity of the kind of thoughts and views of what is actually a really great, you know, artist. It's a very artistic way to look at religion, the fact that we have some role in the interpretation and the expression of all of that. So my dad was, in addition to being, you know, a seeker of spiritual things, he was also a seeker of success, and he wanted to get rich quick. So he was an idea guy. He had tons and tons of ideas. I think he must have started a business every other week, you know, my entire childhood. And none of them really ever went beyond a couple of weeks. He loved starting things, and he wasn't as much of a finisher. So he would get a new idea and he'd get excited about it, and we would move, you know, we would move somewhere in America. I lived half my life in America, half my life in Canada. And a lot of that was, you know, in a vehicle.
Why did you need to move with each new idea?
Well, that's a very good question. You know, I don't necessarily think that we did. You know, he was just drawn to different places for different reasons. I don't even really know the full stories. I think he would hear about something that was happening in Texas or California or Washington or Indiana. You know, we ended up moving to Canada several times, going back and forth. But because we were so poor, Canada is a very social country. They don't let poor people in very easily. So it took us 18 years to get immigrated, but we finally did. But I spent my entire childhood kind of following my dad's dreams. Interestingly, like in his version of the story, you know, and what he was looking for, those dreams, you know, never were quite realized. But the fascinating thing to me is that even though you could say his idea of what he wanted to happen never happened for him, he gave me this really beautiful example that it's okay to just start your own business. You know, it's like, what do? It's Tuesday, you start a business. And that is not a usual thing that children get to see. And I started my first business, I don't know, maybe I was 6 or 7. It's called Happy Garbage Company. And we were at an apartment building, and we were on, I don't know, the 5th floor or something. And I had to take my trash down every week, you know, for the family. And I really didn't like doing it. And so it made me think other people must also not like doing it. And so I created this subscription model, which was actually quite early for its time. For $5 a week, I would take your trash down to the central trash location. And I think at the height, I had 7 clients and I was making $35 a week, which was an incredible amount of money, you know, at the time for me. So it didn't last long because, of course, we moved. But I'm deeply thankful to my father, one, for just being strange enough, you know, that the normal story didn't fit for him. And secondly, you know, for being somebody who wasn't afraid to dare to believe that his ideas, you know, might matter or be important to other people. And those two things served as an incredible example to me. And from a very early age, you know, I was practicing all of that. I think another aspect of the moving all of the time that ended up becoming very formative is humans are so fascinating. I mean, I could say so much about all the reasons why I'm so fascinated with humans. But one of the things that's so interesting is, to me, is the way that we build identity, you know, and we will attach to things, we will attach to objects, we will attach to environments and locations and relationships, a lot of things that are outside of ourselves. And because of this experience I had of constantly moving, you know, we couldn't really carry that much more than was in a car. So I didn't have a lot of physical possessions. And most of what was in the car was my father's books that he carried around all of those places. So I had very little physical possessions. And then, you know, I don't have any concept of at all of like what a childhood home is. I see a flicker of rooms that I don't even think belong, you know, to similar places when I think of a childhood home. And then the most formative by far was never being able to establish long-term friendships. Not until I was really into my early 30s, late 20s or early 30s, did I really start being able to do that. That was formative for 100 reasons. I mean, yeah. I think the most important would probably be that I felt very isolated growing up and spent a lot of time by myself. And we were also, you know, in addition to being like a strange family, we were the strangest family inside of, you know, the strange religious exploration movement. So it was rings within rings within rings of isolation. As a result, I spent a lot of time with myself. I spent a lot of time imagining things. I met many, many people as a child for very short amounts of time.
I'm going to pause for a minute because there's already a couple things and I just want to make sure, sure. I want to touch on some of them. One is this idea of when you mentioned identity, and what's fascinating to me about that is we so often form huge chunks, if not our entire identity, by what's reflected back to us and the solidity of what's reflected back to us. Like you said, the childhood home, the same kids we go to school with, the same community, neighborhood, everything. And so what's interesting to me about all of this is how your world, in always changing, didn't give you anything to hold on to. And in all of your looking at identity, where did your identity come from in all of that?
It's a really good question. I mean, something that I'm super fascinated with personally is the formation of character, personality. One of the easiest ways that I know to describe my understanding of it is if you think of a hand and you see its ability to take different shapes, you know, it can take the shape of a thumbs up, it can take the shape of a peace sign, it can take the shape of a hand that is opening a doorknob. You could say, well, imagine if the hand was like trying to find out who it really was, you know, and so it shifts between all of these shapes and it's like, who am I really? What's my real shape? It's very obvious an example of a hand that none of the shapes are who the hand really is. And it could literally shift between thousands or millions of different possible combinations. None of them would be more who the hand really is than any of the others. And personality is the exact same way. It's just different mental shapes, different configurations of chemicals and thoughts and, you know, patterns that we pick up. It's very similar to that. And so if you were to say, well, who is the hand really? The hand is none of the shapes. The hand is the ability to take shape. That's what the hand is, way more than any of the specific shapes. And if that's true of our hand, it's true 1,000 times of the mind. But what happens is, for a lot of reasons, you know, partly just efficiency and faculty, you know, we learn how to assume certain shapes, and then we become those shapes. And we usually just rotate between a few of them. You know, but there are very clear differences in people's personality shapes that they have, which is, I think, most clearly illustrated by you could be with your best friend out having lunch or something, and then you see your ex walk by. And as soon as you see your ex walk by, your entire physiology shifts, your entire perspective shifts, your heart starts racing, possibly. It depends what your relationship is with your ex, you know, but there's a completely different character or version of yourself that comes out at that moment. And then maybe your mom comes, and then that's a different piece of you, and maybe who you are for your friends at work, who you are for your best friend. But still, most people probably only cycle regularly between maybe 5 to 8 to 10 different versions of themselves. And I'm really interested in, how did we become those ones? Why did we choose these ones? Because to your question exactly, in reply, I would say, we do learn by example more than any other thing. And you're exactly right that I didn't have any firm examples in front of me to decide who I was. So what was reflected back to me was constant change. So I think I identify probably more with constant change than any other aspect, you know, of life. And that has been massively helpful to me as an artist, as a business person, as just a human. One of my favorite quotes is Darwin, you know, who obviously studied the survival of species his entire life. And he says, it's not the strongest that survive, nor the most intelligent, but those most responsive to change. Mm-hmm. And so responsiveness to change, adaptability, is by far the number one attribute that leads to you know, successful ability to reproduce and to grow. That aspect is really at the highlight and at the core of anyone who we've ever considered great in our history. But the mass of people, the mass of culture, does not practice responsiveness to change to any great degree. It's our quote-unquote heroes, you know, people who discover things and all of that. And so what I kind of study, part of it, you know, a big part of my work is dispelling, you know, the myth that some people are born like that, that some people are great, some people are heroic, and other people aren't. It's just that people have practiced different shapes is all that it is, you know? And so I'm really interested in not just shapes that are more, you know, successful for what we're trying to do, but even more than, you know, success or anything like that, what I'm actually interested in is relevance. And that's a really important distinction, because what happens sometimes with this like set of shapes that we have is, let's say you have a thumbs up and a peace sign, you know, and the door handle opener, like I was saying, you could say, well, those are good shapes. I'm a good person, you know? And so someone says, would you like more spaghetti? And you raise the thumbs up, you know? And then someone's like, would you like a back rub? And you raise the thumbs up, you know? But then someone says, would you like, you know, me to kick you in the shins? And you go to raise that thumbs up, and suddenly you're like, oh no, you know, and you feel stuck in that. Or maybe you switch to the peace sign, but that's not the appropriate one either, you know? And then you switch to that door handle, and that's not the appropriate one. And what happens in moments like that is people end up creating judgments about themselves, that they're not good, or they're not effective, or they're not, you know, they're not what needs to happen in that moment.
And it's also, when we grow up using the hand as the example, let's say I always see myself, let's say that I'm the hand, I always see myself as the thumbs up, then, and I want to take this into, actually I want to take this into the conversation of possibility, because I was thinking of going here much later in the conversation, but the fact that you're bringing it up now means I think it will help tie it into the relevance of creativity. Sure. And being an artist, which is, when I see myself as a thumb and then as a thumbs up and stay that way, then my world becomes everything that is connected to me being the thumbs up, and anything.
Absolutely.
Else, there's no space for anything else. Right. So I send some pre-interview questions, and in one of them, I asked about your advice, and you said to not underestimate yourself. Do whatever it takes to learn how to see yourself clearly. And so then the question I thought of, that, like, this pertains to it. And like, if I see myself as a thumbs up, I'm not seeing clearly. But what does it take to see oneself clearly, to be able to be the thumbs up, the peace sign, to be whatever it is in the situation that the best thing the situation is asking of me?
Well, there's another quote I love, that is, you know, when you're walking around with a hammer, everything looks like a nail.
Right.
And it's directly what you're talking about, where as you see this thumbs up, and once you assume a shape, everything that you experience becomes relational to that specific shape. It's not that the shapes are bad. Like I said, to be able to open a door is a really important shape to be able to learn. But what's just as important is to be able to understand that you are beyond any of the specific shapes, and to practice dissolving back to open hand. Because from the place of open hand, the hand can then go and explore different shapes to assume. And I think part of the problem that we have, we like to be good at things, and we like to specifically not be bad at things in front of other people. And so as a young child, you're almost always in the state of open hand, and you'll try almost anything. You know, you won't worry too much about what other people think. And then as you get older and older into, you know, your little bit later childhood, and then into your teens, into your adult, people become so incredibly shaped by their subconscious fear of not wanting to be kicked out of the tribe, that people will tend to stick with the shapes that they already know. And the problem with that, there's several problems with that, but one of the main ones is, how many shapes can the hand take potentially? Infinite, you know? And then how many do most people end up practicing and getting really good at? Like I said, maybe 5 or 10. That's a lot to have lost. And the worst part about it is that once people practice that for so long, it's completely forgotten that you ever were anything else. The brain does this really beautiful thing, very powerful thing, which is, anything that you practice, you will become masterful at over long periods of time, because that part of the brain is assuming that something that you're spending that much energy and time on is going to be helpful to your survival. So when you've practiced being these specific shapes for so long, we really lose touch with this other part of us. And it's not a small thing to have lost. You know, infinite is a rather large thing to have lost. And so to be able to practice disidentifying from the shapes that you have is really, really important. The Eastern philosophies like Buddhism refer to that as beginner's mind. And it's to be able to go back to this open hand and not know what the best way to treat the situation is. The other aspect that's challenging, hold on one sec,
because before we go, before we talk about also how that happens, is to tie that into why that's so important to creativity and to making.
Sure. Well, there's another quote that I love by a guy named Albert Zensky-Yorsky, who discovered vitamin C, and he won a Nobel Prize for it. You know, somebody's impacted the lives of probably billions of people. He said, discovery consists of looking at the same thing as everyone else, but seeing something different. And when we go back to, you know, talking about this thumbs up or having the hammer in your hand, everything looking like a nail, we tend to see and experience things in relation, you know, to the present shape that we're in. And as I said, because a lot of identity has a lot to do subconsciously and biologically with wanting to be a part of a tribe, part of a unit, to not be rejected from that tribe. Because, you know, thousands of years ago, when you were rejected from the tribe, it meant death. It meant basically certain death, because we're a pack animal, you know, especially back then, you know, we still are. It's just important too, I think, if a person is facing that really strong fear of what other people think, or they want to live a more normal life, you know, because they're afraid to disappoint their parents, or because they feel like they need to, et cetera, et cetera. We really shouldn't be hard on ourselves about that at all, because we have to remember that our ancestors, the people that we came from, were people who tended to be more paranoid, who tended to be overly concerned with what the rest of the group thought of them, because those were the ones that stayed with the pack. We probably had really wild, brave, bold, you know, ancestors who didn't give a fuck what anybody thought. Just went out and did their own thing. Those people were not as likely to survive a lot of the time, you know, in the very harsh world that they were living in. So the ones that lived to pass on their genetics down to us, you know, tended to be quite strongly fear-based, you know, quite strongly interested in the opinions of other people. And so we're carrying that in our genes. And that's where we came from. But it also is not serving us on many, many, many levels. You know, so going back to how does all this apply to creativity? If discovery consists of looking at the same thing as everyone else, but seeing something different, then you really have to dig down into, well, where does seeing come from? And is seeing actually even a choice? Because most people don't think of seeing as a choice. They reflect and respond to these predetermined shapes that most people are. If everybody in the room is a thumbs up and you come in with some other kind of shape, you'll immediately get the attention of everyone else in the room. Mm-hmm. Generally, it will be at least suspicious, if not, you know, downright fearful or aggressive. And we're seeing that play out, you know, right now in a lot of different places in the world. And, you know, for all people are saying this is a new thing, or how can this be happening? This is an ancient thing, and this is just another expression of this same thing. But it's this ancient biological impulse to fear the unknown. Okay, so if on one side of this we have an ancient biological impulse to fear the unknown, and then on the other side we have a Nobel Prize winner telling us, here's what you have to do to discover things. You have to explore into the unknown. Then that creates an incredible amount of tension between those two opposites. What a person really has to do to become powerful at being creative is to overcome ancient biological impulses that subtly and subconsciously will continuously steer you towards things that you already know, towards things that are already accepted, that will steer you away from experiences that have even a small possibility of you facing rejection of any kind. And because most people are not aware of those impulses, or just, you know, vaguely aware of them, or perhaps underestimate the power of them, they will continually, in very small, invisible ways, make choices that will keep them from exploration. Coming back to your question, you know, about shape and identity, not knowing who you are is actually closer to the truth than knowing who you are, just mathematically, because there will always be more shapes that we can take that we don't know. And so when people get really firm and clear on, you know, I'm like this, I like these three things, I don't like this, that ends up, you know, creating an experience of life that is repetitive. Somebody who is a thumbs up will tend to put themselves in certain kinds of situations where they can get by on that, where that will work for them. And they will tend to avoid situations where that doesn't work for them. And I'm not saying that that's necessarily bad, but what creativity really is, Steve Jobs said it best, I think. He said, creativity is just connecting things. I think that is so brilliant and so poignant, you know, and so simple. And he was a master, you know, of making very complex things simple. And he said, creativity is just connecting things. So if you look at creativity as just connecting things, what you realize is all you need is a bunch of different things and play with different combinations of them. And then you end up finding really interesting combinations. Not every time, probably 1 out of 1,000 combinations you might try is going to be interesting, but it requires you to have the mindset or the perspective to be willing to shift through 999 different combinations that weren't successful, that weren't popular, that nobody else was looking at, you know, and that's the thing that most of us don't do.
Okay. So one of the things that comes up, it's come up for me over and over, and I hear it over and over and over again, is this question, and huge in creativity and art, is the question of voice. And so when I hear you speaking this way, I'm thinking, where does one's voice fit into this fluidity of identity?
Yes, that's related to style too. You know, people ask questions about style and voice. And for me, I think a lot of times people are approaching that with the cart before the horse, so to speak, because I think a lot of the greats, they weren't thinking in some analytical way about what their voice was and then trying to make things that aligned with their voice. Voice is something that, you know, historians and artistic critics talk about after all of this stuff is made. And I think because we have these giant examples of these, you know, heroes of art in front of us, and we hear it talked about their voice and et cetera, we think we have to go about trying to mimic that somehow, you know, and make a voice of our own. And for me, I think that that actually brings up an analytical part of the mind that is not where creativity comes from. You know, so I have a lot of experience in the photography industry, for instance, and several times as I was exploring things, I ended up, you know, finding things that were interesting to other people, and trends got created out of it. And so I was a part of that process and saw that process many times. And what will tend to happen is somebody will do something interesting. Other people will look at it, and then they will try to do that too. And that's a beautiful part of how knowledge spreads and inspiration spreads, et cetera, et cetera. But it's never as fulfilling to the people that imitate as to the original person who makes the discovery. But there's far more people who imitate than people that discover, for the exact reasons I was just discussing. It's mm-hmm. safer to imitate because it's already been proven that it's accepted by the pack, at least to some degree. It's very unsafe, you know, on a subconscious, you know, biological, ancient level of trying stuff that we don't know if it's going to work or not yet. The way I talk about that in the most simple form, I think, would be, I love joy. Joy is the thing I think that I speak about the most. It's the center of everything that I do. And that didn't happen immediately. I was actually studying creative genius for a long time. I was studying connection for a long time. And then I realized those things were actually the same thing. Mm-hmm. Because anybody who's considered a creative genius is somebody who connected with a lot of other people, you know? And so what is the common denominator between all of that? It's joy. And joy for me is that feeling of being alive. And so I use joy as a compass. I think the aspect of our brain that produces joy, the instrument, you know, that sends it out, that to me should be the centerpiece of every single human's life. Whether you consider yourself a creative or whether you consider yourself any other thing, joy is the compass. Because if you want to talk about voice, forget any certain style, just follow things that light your entire body on fire. And after doing that for years and years and years and years, you will have been gravitated towards certain things. You will have explored certain things. You will have discovered certain things, and let other people come after you and say, well, that was her voice, you know? That was his voice. That was his style. Let them worry about that. You know, I think it was Marianne Williams who said, don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive, because what the world needs is people who have come alive. Typically be attributed, you know, to this particular question. Don't ask what your voice is, you know, ask what makes you come alive, because your voice is just a collection of things that made you come alive.
It's interesting to hear you say this, because I've been online about 10 years as a entrepreneur, you know, had like a presence online, and that almost that whole time I have struggled with this idea of what is my personality, my online personality, and nothing. It always wasn't happening, always so much trying and looking out. And then fairly recently, everything kind of shifted into place. So I'm very curious to hear your response to what I'm about to share. But what happened for me was I realized, oh, when I come from love, it works. Like, so for me, maybe I'm calling, like, yes, love is joy.
And semantics.
Right. And so it's like, oh, but what's fascinating to me is that when I come from love, I have the feeling of I know who I am. So how does that work with what you're saying around this idea?
Yeah, I used to talk about love too. And I think the reason why I don't anymore is because it's so tied up with our ideas of romanticism and relationship in that kind of a way. And so it's just, for me, it's a very muddied word, you know. And there's also so many people, you know, who have said, this is in the name of love, let's kill everyone, you know. So I just, personally, I always love kind of new, fresh palettes to explore. If I am using an old word, I wanna revamp it. So for me, I like joy, because joy is not very controversial, and it's very kind of clear to see whether somebody is or isn't in joy in a given moment. Whereas love is a much more, you know, subtle thing. But I would say, you know, in understanding of what you were meaning, yes, absolutely. What came to me as you were talking is, you imagine like yourself and the person you're closest with in the world. And it's an early Sunday morning, and you're on a bed, and it's quiet, and you've just woken up recently, you're talking softly to each other, your heads are really close, almost so close that your eye can't focus anymore, and it just feels so, 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 so good. And in that moment, neither of you are wondering, but who am I? It's ridiculous to even think about that, you know? It's like, but what's my voice, you know? What's my style of interaction with this person? It's like, that's the analytical head trying to figure things out. Just follow this feeling of beauty. And I could talk about beauty so much too, because beauty is what draws us and what attracts us, you know? And beauty is what leads us, you know, into joy. It's the joy that's separate from us, you know, that we need to go towards. And one thing I say about beauty that I think is interesting is how that beauty is actually stronger than gravity. And gravity is possibly, you know, among the most powerful physical forces in the universe. Beauty is stronger than gravity because it was the beauty of the stars and the beauty of the mystery of what might be up there that made us build these rockets, you know, that overcame gravity to take us off this planet. Beauty will take us deep into the solar system. It will take us to the far reaches, you know, of the universe. Beauty is stronger than gravity. I think that's a really interesting thing. And when you look at, you know, all the things we are attracted to, there's different levels of attraction. You know, there's different reasons why we're attracted to different things. So I'm not saying all attraction necessarily, you know, could be equated to what I would consider beauty, but there is a certain kind of attraction that speaks to a certain part of us. And for me, again, the central thing between all of the wildly different things I explore is always just joy. Because at the end of the day, you know, what's the purpose of higher learning if it doesn't bring you joy? At the end of the day, if you know, you have all the money or success in the world, what's the point of it if it doesn't end up in joy? If you have the person that you've always wanted, you finally get with them, what's the purpose if it doesn't lead to joy? So to me, joy is the central figure of all of it. And that's an aspect, you know, that I think each of us would be so well served to really invest the long time it will take to understand and access that piece of us. So tying that into one of your earlier questions, you know, about how do we see ourselves clearly? I think in some kind of way that can be asked from the perspective of what's my voice, what's my style, who am I? Or you can do it this reverse way, the more uncommon way that I'm talking about. And that the way, in my opinion, all the most interesting people who have ever lived, this is how they lived. They didn't try to figure out who they were in some analytical, comparative kind of way. What they did do is they paid an inordinate, uncommon amount of attention on what made them come alive.
Right.
And then slowly over time, you get so familiar with situations like that. Honestly, I can say that I have had so many experiences of feeling alive in my life, so many moments of joy, that I feel like in some ways I've lived, you know, 100 lifetimes. And it's such a regular occurrence for me at this point that there is no chance you could convince me to living a different way. And so in that way, it's like the rich get richer, so to speak, because you get used to experiencing it that much, that often, and you can't go down from that place.
Okay, so from there, I want to ask about that struggle between what makes us come alive and wanting and needing this ancient drive to fit in and to not be kicked out of the tribe, because often those are at odds with each other, right?
So yes.
If they're at odds with each other and our instinct is to want to fit in, but our longing is to come alive, how do we dance that dance to actually create something that makes us come alive, to live a life, but in terms of art, making something that leads to that feeling?
There's this really interesting book that I heard about recently, and I haven't read it yet, but I just love the title so much that I'm going to talk about it, and that is this idea of the opposable mind. And just the short subject of the whole book, as I understand it, is this idea that humans have this opposable thumb. You know, it's on the other side of all of our fingers, and a lot of the other animals don't have that. And because we have this opposable thumb, we're able to use tools in a much more complex way than beings that don't have that. So the interesting thing about the opposable thumb is it pushes in the opposite direction of the fingers, which allows you to hold things. So in reference to what we're talking about, you've got these two really strong forces. You know, you've got this biological, you know, need, impulse to be a part of the tribe. And then we've got this other piece of us, there's this longing to go out and discover and be wild. Those are two opposite forces, and they're both beautiful. I really don't want to put down that strong biological need for the other. I think it is talked about in a negative way a lot of the time, but let's face it, a lot of the best moments of our life are in shared community, which we wouldn't have if we were all off by ourselves, exploring the wilderness, you know, by ourselves. So I think they're both beautiful, but I think an over amount of either one leads to imbalance and can be dangerous and disruptive to the healthy kind of life that we want. I do think, you know, there's a part of this analytical mind that's always searching for this exact answer. When I was a kid, I used to ask that question all of the time. You know, I would see these powerful artists. I got to meet several really amazing artists in my crazy life as I grew up that had really big impacts on me. And I would watch them just be brilliant and amazing. And I would say, I'll come up to them after their talk or their speech or their poetry reading or their concert or whatever, you know, and because I was kind of an unusual child, I would say, how did you do that? You know, and they would look at me intensely and just, they would sometimes put their hand on my shoulder and they would say, follow your heart. And it for years, I was like, what does that even mean? What does follow your heart even mean? But now I understand it's what I'm talking about. You know, it's, there is an aspect in you that pays attention at any given moment. Is this making me come alive? In any moment, you are either alive or you are not. You know, even that saying, like, I feel so alive right now. That is a really fascinating statement because it suggests that there's a lot of times that we don't feel alive. And that's a funny thing to even think about. Like, what is it in us that feels alive? Like, that's a sliding scale somehow. So for me, presence is a sense. We've got, you know, vision and we've got hearing and we've got taste. Presence is a sense, and presence is the sense in you that senses how alive you are. And for me, joy happens when you feel so alive that it has to break the bounds of the body in some way. You have to change, you have to move, you have to get up, you have to go text that person, you have to go climb the mountain, you have to smile, you have to shout, you have to lift your hands. It's a movement, it's an exploration, almost always outside of pattern. One last thing about this particular piece I would say is, I heard another quote recently, I won't remember the guy's name because it was this really long Indian name that I was mispronouncing, but it's a really beautiful, and it's something like, love tells me I am everything. Wisdom tells me I am nothing. And between those two banks flows the river of my life. And I just think, oh, that is so profoundly beautiful and powerful, you know, to just understand, yes, there are these two completely opposite aspects of life, and they are both completely true. And what it is to be a human is somehow to be in between those two banks, you know, and to be this moving wild thing in between these two completely opposite shorelines with completely different rules. And you see that duality all throughout the human experience. You see yin and yang, you see male and female, you see the garden east and the garden west. You know, it's, we are in between those two things, the tree of life and the tree of good and evil knowledge. You know, it's, we're there in between that. And I think both of them are us. We're spirit and we're physical, and we're somehow neither of those. We're the mix of the two, you know? And so I think it's important to honor all of those pieces.
Yeah. Okay. Let me just think for a minute where I want to go, because
it's hard to talk about any of this succinctly. I mean,
oh yeah,
I could have answered all these questions completely different ways.
Yeah, I get that. And I think what's important for me in the asking of the question is this idea of how do we become more of who we are so that we are capable, so that we connect deeply with what it is we are here or feel compelled to make. And that whatever stands in the way of that, how do we shift that so that we can actually make what we want? Mm-hmm. And then there's the practical piece of, okay, let's talk about business. Then let's talk about how we do mm-hmm. that. So I'm just thinking, just want to have one last thing on, mm-hmm. on this topic that we've been talking about, because I see it also in terms of something as simple as Instagram. So I was talking with a friend the other day, and forgetting that this historically cannot be possible. If you imagine like Matisse and Van Gogh and Picasso and George mm-hmm. O'Keefe and all of them sitting around in a circle going, well, I only got this many likes on my image. How many likes did you mm-hmm. get? And I was going to go with this like, hey, series, but I think I'm not, because it doesn't seem like people like it. And mm-hmm. like how different our world would be if that's how we chose to live, if we created from the number of likes that we get. And yet we do. So mm-hmm. we are all, it's just like what you're saying, we are caught up in, I'm caught up in it. And so I just, anything else that you want to add into what you've already said around this thing, like the very practical piece of, I'm going to share my work on Instagram, and then, ooh, maybe it didn't get the response I wanted to, and now I close up, and now I'm not sure I want to share anymore. Or, ooh, I got a lot of response. I guess I'll move more in that direction. And yeah.
Well, I think that's a great transition into talking about business too, because art, you know, as a singular pursuit is about yourself. You know, at least the impetus of art, how it starts, is about yourself. And then business is actually about we, you know, business is a collaborative art form. I shouldn't say all art is individual. I'm saying the way a lot of people approach, you know, their artistic practice is an individual thing. And there is a big piece of it that does need to be individual, you know, like Tesla, you know, who obviously was one of the most powerful artists and inventors of all time, having discovered AC electricity, among other things. He says, if you want to know the secret of invention, be alone. you know? Mm-hmm. And the time alone with yourself is so important and so powerful. And I could talk for so many reasons about that, but very simply put, especially in terms of what we've been talking about, you don't really change without self-reflection. And self-reflection is time that's spent watching yourself, you know? And I've been really interested recently in what does relationship with the self mean? You know, I'm 38 years old, and I didn't even really know that I had a body until September. I actually realized, like, oh, I have a body, you know, I just started getting interested in, like, these are my fingers, you know, these are my hands,
okay.
These are my veins, this is my chest, you know, these are my knees, I have a heart in there. And it's like, I had a vague idea, you know, that I had a heart, but I never really took my time and presence and attention to put that directly on my heart. And for the first time in my entire life in September, I spoke directly to my heart, and I was like, hi, I know we haven't ever talked before, but I just thought I would reach out and say, how are you doing? And a funny thing happened, and there was a silence. The heart didn't say anything back to me, but it was a pregnant silence. It was a silence of somebody who was stunned that I was talking to them. So I felt this awareness in my heart that I had never been aware of before. And I said, do you need anything from me? Like, what can I do for you? What can I do for you? And it didn't say anything to me, but this image flashed in my mind. And the image was of, you know, itself, the heart, wrapped in this black velvet. And as soon as I saw that, it hit my emotional center, because I realized it was saying, you know, that I had been hiding it, you know, that I haven't abused my heart in the way that some people have, but I have definitely wrapped it in this soft black velvet, you know, and hidden it from people, hidden it from myself. And I was like, oh, what do you want? Like, I can see that. Like, what do you want from me? And it sent another image, and the image was of my hands, just my bare hands holding it, that feeling of closeness, just that skin on skin, you know, cell on cell. And again, it hit my emotional center really strongly. This is a completely wild thing for me. Like, I had never even considered doing anything like this. And I started crying, because it was such a powerful feeling of reconnection, you know, with this specific aspect. And then it spoke, and I heard its voice in my mind, and it said, don't leave me, don't leave me, don't leave me. And I realized I had been taught to leave my heart, like most of us have. I basically completely objectified my entire body as if it wasn't even a thing. It's a living, moving, breathing, priceless, incredibly intelligent, powerful thing. You know, people treat their dogs way better than most people treat their own bodies. They give their dogs more attention and love than they treat their own bodies. And so this whole huge exploration has been opening up for me over this summer and this fall of really starting to build relationship with myself, which I've heard about a million times, but never actually really thought about in a practical sense. How do you build relationship with the self, which is at the core of what any good artist will tell you? You have to have a relationship with yourself. How do you have a relationship with yourself? The same way any other relationship is formed, and that is through presence and active listening and active, honest, genuine communication through conversations. So I've started this practice of having physical conversations with different aspects of my own body. And it's been absolutely extraordinary. It's one of the most important things that's happened in my artistic journey in my entire life.
I want to tie that into business, because that's where we were going. And I also want to ask, like, how, when you say it's one of the most extraordinary parts of your life and your artistic journey, what are ways that it has shifted your
journey? Well, that really actually is a whole huge, huge subject that I'm happy to go into, but it's a little bit different than this other one we were on. We went on a tangent there. So just to go back to the other question that you said, because I think it's an important one about, you know, Picasso and Van Gogh and whoever sitting around, you know, wondering about Instagram stuff. I think a really important piece with all that is to remember that they didn't know which of their paintings were going to be their quote-unquote best. That's a super, super important thing to know. You look at somebody like Picasso, who I believe made more than 60,000 works in his life. 60,000, you know, he's an incredibly prolific, you know, artist. He had no idea which of his were going to be the best or not, you know. And my guess is that a lot of them that are now considered the best weren't necessarily his favorites. You don't always know. And again, that's that kind of misconception that we have sometimes looking backwards. We look back at his and we identify his 20 best pieces and we're like, this is the work of Picasso. And it's like, that's a tiny sliver of the work of Picasso. The work of Picasso was equally 6 o'clock in the morning when he was sketching something that he ended up throwing away. That's just as much the work of Picasso as, you know, the famous blue guitar player. It's just, that's not how we think about it. So we have a lot of misconceptions about the artistic process that really actually hamper the artistic process. Because what a lot of people, you know, in today's culture and people who are on the artistic path and Instagram culture and all of that, we're trying to make the blue guitarist on purpose on the count of three. One, two, three, blue guitarist. And then we don't do it. And then we judge ourselves. Well, I guess I'm just not a Picasso. It's like Picasso didn't just make 20 great paintings. He made 60,000 paintings, the vast majority of which were not interesting, you know, to him or anybody else. But that's the only way that you get to 20 brilliant paintings, you know? So coming back to your question about Instagram and its effect and its influence on us, it can be very dangerous in some ways because we see these end results. We see blue guitar players being posted constantly if we're following people, you know, who we really love. And we're forgetting that those blue guitar players are on the visible part of a thousands of image long journey to get to that place. And we don't see all of those other thousands. And because we don't see those, it makes it easy for us to not understand what that fully is, you know? It would be like thinking that an apple just became an apple. And it's like, nope, an apple, this delicious, beautiful thing, is on the back end of a 15, 20 year journey, you know, where right before that it was a twig, before that it was a branch, before that it was a trunk, before that it was roots, before that it was, you know, the seed. You can't eat any of that stuff. You can only eat the thing at the very end, this tiny, beautiful, you know, golden thing that's at the end of this super long process, the vast majority of which is just not palatable. It's not digestible. And this tying back into this other concept we were talking about before of needing to be a part of the pack, there's a deep need in humans to only spend time doing things that are going to lead to digestible outcomes. And you can't get to new that way. You just can't. To really create something that's powerful and moving and engaging and shifts industries and cultures and minds, it's always only at the back end of a long journey, the vast majority of which people will not come with you for. You will be alone in that. One of my sayings that I love is that kind of succinctly describes that entire thing is to be masterful in front of others at anything requires thousands of hours of practice when no one else is watching. And most people value attention too much to spend the time away from it that mastery requires. So there's this long piece of the journey, you know, that can't be ignored. It just can't. So what I love about Instagram and all of that is you can share blue guitars really quickly, easily with other people. For business, I think it can be very powerful because you can get a gauge on how a certain work of yours is connecting with a larger audience. That's a very valuable thing to know. It's great to produce work that makes you feel great. That's one beautiful thing. But if you want to be in business, you have to produce work that makes other people feel great. And learning the balance between those two things is a really important thing. But it can't be used as an excuse to skip out on that back end of the work. And what you have out there is tons of people who call themselves creatives or want to be creatives, but if they're really honest with themselves, they're not producing work that regularly draws them into a state of joy. And I don't care how much money you have. I don't care how many followers you have. I don't care how many likes you have. If you are not producing work that lights you up, you're losing. You're losing the game of life. You know, so it's a separate thing. It's a separate, you know, thing than these measurable, quantifiable results of success. And that's why we have situations like Anthony Bourdain, you know, and Kate Spade, who are at the very top, you know, of success as artists in by so many definitions. And yet on the dark side of it, on the back end, were in moments, you know, apparently of deep despair and deep disconnection. And both of those things can coexist. Both of those things can be happening at the same time. But how much joy you're feeling is often this private, hidden thing. How much internal conflict you're going through is this private, hidden thing that nobody else can see. And because the brain values these quantifiable, measurable, how many people are following me, how much money did I make things, we can overemphasize the amount of time and attention we're placing on that to the detriment and the great loss of missing out on the very simple but profoundly impactful and important question of, but am I in joy right now? Am I doing things that are making me come alive? Because if you get too separated from that, you know, you will have gained the whole world but lost your soul, as Jesus said.
That's it. Like, that's, I have to like gather my thoughts because different thoughts were coming and then they just all went out of my head. You just bridged the gap right there when I talked about this duality between wanting to fit in and wanting to create amazing art. It's like, that's the gap, is the joy. That, yes. Well, that's the bridge for all of it. And honestly, this is one of the things that why I love having these conversations, because these having conversations with people who tell the truth lets me know that how I feel is,
yes, it's okay,
is normal. And yep. Then I think what we get to do, just in what you're saying, like we want to fit in so much that we try to be like everybody else. And what I've learned from these conversations is, oh, the doubt, the loneliness, the fear, that is like everybody else. So yes. I can, it's okay to be moving through that world because that is the world we all move through.
Yes.
And absolutely. Then we look for the joy. Like, is this bringing joy? I mean, it's so beautiful. I just love how you framed all of this. So, okay.
Joy is really beautiful too when you start talking about business. And to me, again, joy is a central piece for me for so many reasons. But what I found is that something that has a high likelihood of making me feel joy will make other people in the world feel joy also. So that was also my indicator to explore into, you know, the way that I conduct business too. So I don't know if you're ready to talk about that part yet.
Yes, I am. And I want to underscore that with something I recently interviewed Love is Wise, and she's an illustrator and she's an amazing young woman. And one of the things she said is that when she shares pieces of her art that are personal to her, but that are made with a lot of joy, a lot of love, a lot of light, she inevitably gets commissions from that sharing because people see the joy, they see the love, and they want more of that. So yeah, let's move into the business piece of it. And I've worked with a lot of creative entrepreneurs, artists. You come into business and this heaviness enters into the conversation.
immediately.
And it's like, I love the making, I don't want to do the marketing, and I don't want to do all that other stuff, and I don't even know if I like any of it, and it doesn't feel good. So how do you talk about business and creativity and bring them together in a way where there's a lightness for all of it, where we can be in the business piece of it in a way that is joyful and light?
Yeah, so I teach a program called Business as an Art Form, and it's a 6-month mentorship program where I take 10 people each time, and we go really deep into, you know, this process that I've created around, you know, how I've spent the last 15 years of my life, which is basically I wake up every day, you know, and I decide what I want to do and how I want to build my business based on one thing and one thing alone, and that is how much joy that it brings me. So my entire business is one of the things that's most different about the way I do business than, you know, the classical ways of thinking about it is that the point of my business is not to make money. The point of my business is to improve my quality of life. And that's a really, really important distinction, because we kind of have this idea in our, you know, society that we get more money and then our life gets better. And I grew up very poor, as I said. So, you know, the amount of money that I've had over these last years so incredibly, you know, dwarfs where I came from that it would be like, you know, an entirely different life. But the thing is that you find once you get more money is then there's more things to spend it on. You know? Yeah, what you want and what you need keeps changing, you know, and so there never really is enough. And enough is like a really interesting whole conversation to have around all of that too. So anyways, but coming back to this, no matter what money you're making, no matter what level that it's at, I think a more interesting way to look at it is quality of life, because it's this classic idea we have of work really hard, make lots of money, and then at the end of the day, you know, then you get to spend it on doing what you want. And how do most people in the world spend the money, you know, that they use? A lot of people have this thing like living for the weekend, you know, so they work really hard for 5 days to then do something for 2 days that they won't remember so that they can drown out, you know, what happened in the previous 5 days. And that's really sad when you think about it, that part of our money is being spent helping us to forget the vast majority of the other part, you know, of our life. So what do I mean practically by building a business that's based on your quality of life? I have people go through, you know, awareness practices and self-reflection, you know, to be able to really identify when are they at the most joyful in their life? What kinds of things do they love doing? And then reverse engineer the business to be built specifically around those kinds of things. So again, I'm really into kind of reverse engineering because I like being able to access specific states, you know, of feeling and specific states of mind. And those things happen inside of us. They don't ever happen outside of us. So we're actually the source of all of that. And so I think if you go back to the source and you follow that out, you can make a lot clearer choices, you know, about living like that. And kind of what I mean by that is like going back to this whole Instagram thing, we see people who are quote unquote successful, you know, and it's our favorite illustrator, it's our favorite photographer, it's our favorite, you know, musician or whatever. And then we look at the things that they've done and the things that they're doing, and we know, well, I want to be like them. So then we try to do those things instead of coming from where they came from. Okay, and so it's similar to this metaphor I was talking about with the apple. And the apple is at the long end of a super long invisible journey, and you can't get a real apple without going on that journey. It's impossible. What you can get and what most people try to do is similes of apples. You know, they look like an apple, they feel like an apple, but you can't eat it. It doesn't actually have life inside of it, you know? And it is way easier to make something that looks like an apple than it is to actually make an apple. You know, with all of the height of our science and technology, we still have absolutely no idea even what life is, or how that some random mix of dirt and sunlight ends up becoming an apple. It's really amazing when you think about it, you know? But all of that to say, coming back to this particular aspect, that I think I just lost myself there.
So in connecting it with Instagram and with business, and we see, like what you were saying is, we just see the apple, you know, we see the finished product.
Oh, yes.
That, or we try to imitate that because we want.
Yes.
That. Yeah.
Yeah. So somebody else's success might look differently to you, you know, or a lot of these people who have quote unquote success, you know, I'm actually in an unusual position. Yeah, I live here in Los Angeles, you know, and I work with artists at very high levels, you know, so I've been blessed to meet literally some of my heroes in who are alive in the world, who have produced incredible things. And some of them are not necessarily the, you know, living a life internally that would be as enviable to other people. There's costs associated with everything. And to me, at the end of the day, If you could say on your tombstone, you know, he had 400,000 followers and, you know, had an engagement level of, you know, 27%, you know, if that was on somebody's tombstone, you know, but, you know, he struggled really hard all of the time and he didn't actually even like his life. Or you look at someone else who had, you know, 15 followers and his engagement level was negative 20%. People unfollowed every time that, you know, he spoke. But he was joyful. Like, that is such a deeper form of success to me. I'm not saying the two have to be mutually exclusive. They don't. But I'm saying if you're going to go for one of them, go for the joy one. And if living in your joy and building something that makes you joyful leads you to masses of people following you and adoring you, and that doesn't somehow steal that joy from you, good for you. But at the end of the day, we have our priority mixed, I think. And I understand why. I could tell you, you know, for 20 minutes why that happens biologically, but just because it's in our biology doesn't mean that it's the thing that we have to bow to. And a lot of people, you know, without meaning to, are really signing up to be servants and slaves of these ancient biological impulses. And those things are here to serve us. We're not supposed to be serving them. If we're just here serving all of those things, it's just this endless rat race. That's what the rat race is. You know, it's a constant chasing of this thing that can never really be had. So instead of putting it off into the distance, I just think it's so powerful, important to right from the beginning, go through every aspect of your business, list every single thing that you do in a day, and make a list on a scale of, you know, 1 to 10, how much joy it brings you. And then take a good hard look at all the things that don't bring you joy in your business. And those are the places to start putting creativity. Could you do it differently? Could you come at it from a different angle? Could you involve somebody who maybe does feel joy with this part? And what happens is I just help people create these businesses that serve them instead of them having to serve the business.
And I like that you didn't say the places that don't bring you joy, don't do them. It's like just instead looking at how can I bring joy into those places? What would it take to have this part of it be joyful? And
yes.
Yeah. Something out. Did you want to say something?
Just quickly add that, yeah. You know, I'm not saying every waking moment of your day has to be joyful. And if it's not, you're somehow failing at life and business. And here I am, special California guy, super joyful all the time, you know, and you're doing it wrong. That's not what I'm saying at all. I'm just saying how much joy a person has a lot more to do with them than most people would realize. And joy, the cool thing about it is it spreads, you know? And so if people just had like one really joyful moment in a day, and then they had 5 days like that a week, like that's a pretty good week, you know? And then if you have 3 weeks like that a month, that's a pretty good month. If you do that 10 times a year, like that's a pretty great year. I'm not saying you have to do this 100% of the time. I'm saying like up it by 1%, up it by 3%, you know, 3 moments of joy in a day, like true, deep, powerful joy. That's pretty awesome. You know, and then as you practice, you start getting more and more and more. But even myself, who studies joy, you know, I'm not in a state of joy all of the time. I'm not. I'm just regularly in it, you know. And so I'm not saying every aspect of your business, you know, you can be in joy in every single moment. Maybe you can. I'm certainly not like that at that place yet. But I will say my business brings me a lot of joy, a lot of joy.
I'm glad that you said that. And one thing I wanted to ask you about was something that you had quoted Nietzsche. I don't always know that I'm saying it right, but as in this quote, what you did was you swapped the word life out for business. So I'm going to read it with business as the word. And what he said, and then with the word business, as you added, is the secret of reaping the greatest fruitfulness and the greatest enjoyment from your business is to do business dangerously.
Yes, 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 yes.
So, yeah, tell me.
Well, I think one of my favorite aspects of humans is, you know, the boldness and the grit that it takes to face a charging army, just one person, you know, against the army. And I think that's something that we're fascinated with as a culture, you know. What are superheroes? Why is there such this fascination with superheroes? And before it was superheroes, you know, there were saints. And before there were saints, there were these gods. We've always been fascinated with this idea of these heroes, these people who face incredible odds, you know, and overcome them, you know, and sometimes they die in the process, but it's still a victory just facing it in the first place. And so I really love to stoke that rebel part of creatives, because to be good in business, you have to be willing to draw outside of the lines. You have to be willing to explore. You have to be willing to go against a lot of the ancient biological, you know, instincts. One of the big ways that I there's kind of two main themes that I talk about in the business as an art form kind of methodology, because as you say, when you say the word business to most creatives, almost initially there's a dropping of the shoulders, you know, there's a heaviness that comes on there. And our ideas about business and the way that we see business massively affects our relationship to it, you know. And what people forget a lot of the times is that business doesn't exist anywhere except in your own head. So all of your ideas that you have about business are yours. Your entire business is just an extension of yourself. And so when you have dark ideas associated with that, that's on you. And I don't criticize anybody for that, because there's a lot of dark ideas about business out there, and there's a lot of people experiencing dark things with it. But anything that's in your body, anything that's in your mind, including your thoughts and your beliefs and your relationship, you know, to those things, that's within your ability to change. That's within, I wouldn't even say your right to change. It's even more, it's your responsibility to change that, you know? And so,
and that brings us back to the hand, because if business is just the thumbs up, then we miss all the other aspects of what business can be.
Yes. I lost my track there because I got on a tangent, but what I was saying is, you know, what does it mean to do business dangerously? I think doing a business that's bold, you know, that has some balls to it, you know, is like, it's exciting. It's exciting to do that. And a lot of times we're catering to these ancient instincts that we just want to fit in. And a lot of people are making businesses that would fit in. And that's they're designing their businesses to give them the least amount of awkwardness as possible. They're designing their businesses basically to cater to all of their baser instincts of wanting to be a part of a tribe and not having to be in uncomfortable situations. And I actually use my business oppositely, and I encourage the people that I you know, mentor to build businesses that challenge them, that put them in situations that they're unfamiliar with, for the purpose of growing. My business has been probably, I would say, tied for the biggest single reason that I've grown so much in my life. My business is an exoskeleton that gives me it's a vehicle that takes me into growth. That's what it's designed for. My business is to grow me. That's what my business is for, you know? And so many people feel stifled by their businesses because they've built their businesses based on what someone else told them that their business should look like or feel like, or this is what the common business model is. But to me, I don't care whether my model is common or not. I care more, is it serving me? Is it growing me? Is it bringing me joy? So again, you're reverse engineering, you know, the way that you're looking at the business, building it from the ground up. And in the people that I mentor, you know, I really like to stoke that rebel cry of, let's do something daring. Let's do something that they wouldn't expect. Let's do something that's so gutsy that just hearing about it automatically will you know, tweak people's interests and get them excited about it. I call it business as an art form because business is a form, you know, it's a form of communication, it's a form of interaction, and all forms can be used creatively. And what happens to a lot of artists is they are super creative when it comes to doing, you know, whatever it is that they're making. But when it comes to the business, they're not actually making anything out of the business. They're usually just copying and pasting. Oh, this is how you're supposed to do this business. So if they just copied and pasted their drawings or their music, that wouldn't be exciting to them. Not at all. So I really love exploring how people can self-express through the business.
And where does because a lot of artists and makers don't have training in any business, in making a business. So where does the training, where do the models and the templates and all of that fit in with being the rebel and doing things dangerously?
Well, there's a couple ways to answer that. One is there's this great search, you know, the sifting that has to be done, like Picasso did. He sifted through 60,000, you know, to find 20. Thomas Edison, you know, went through 999 different, you know, models of the tungsten metal mix until he found the one, you know, that made the light bulb. And afterwards they were like, how did you you know, how did you have the patience like to fail that many times? And he's like, I didn't fail, you know, 999 times. I just found 1,000 ways not to make a light bulb, you know, and then I found one that did. So again, there's this commitment to this long journey. And I'm not saying don't use templates and don't use other services out there. Don't do courses or trainings. Do those things to the degree that they're, you know, improving your growth, but most especially joy. If it's bringing you joy, if it resonates with you, something interesting is there for you. But another thing, going back to Picasso, that I think is so beautiful, is he said, bad artists copy and great artists steal. And the difference between copying and stealing is quite profound. You know, copying an apple is making a simile of that apple. You're making a facsimile of it so that it looks similar to an apple, but it's not an actual apple. It doesn't have life inside of it. And many people build their businesses modeling their apple after a real apple. You know, they model their careers after somebody else who had a career. I'm not saying there's no value in that at all, because learning the craft of building things, imitating, that's how we do that. But the problem is many people end up building these things that at the end of the day aren't giving them life. They're not bringing them joy. And I don't care what level of monetary success or fame success you get to, if it's not bringing you joy, you've missed the mark, you know? So coming back down to that original line of questioning, like another thing that I really love is Jesus, how he talks about it. He says, here's how you know the truth, because it will set you free. That's the indicator of truth. And there's this weird thing that humans have where we call something the truth, and because we've called it the truth, then we think it's the truth just because we've put that name on it, you know? And we do a similar thing with success. We call it success, so it's success. You know, somebody else said this was success, so it's success. And I'd say throw out all of that and just use Jesus as indicator for your business. If it's setting you free, if it feels like it's making you come alive, if you resonate with it when you hear it, then it's for you. Then go deeper into that. You know, just don't keep adding weights to yourself that you think you should have this because you're supposed to have this. So I think doing a business dangerously to me, you know, is in part talking about don't just accept what's handed to you, you know, have the agency to weigh it and to test it and to say, does this add to me? Does this make me come alive? And if not, throw it out and get it as far away from you as you possibly can, because we only have so much space. And most people's space is just completely filled with things that are draining them and sucking them dry and not growing them and not bringing them joy. And so by the time they've gotten through all of that stuff, they have this tiny little thimble full to hold up to say, well, here's, you know, here's my capacity for joy. Here's my space for joy. And you do that for years and years and years, and you start getting these very concrete ideas of, well, maybe I'm just not the kind of person who can feel joy. Maybe I'm just not meant for that, you know? And when do people classically have the largest transformations in their life? When some tragedy comes along and steals everything from them. And so they've got this fresh, clean palette again. And I'm telling you, you don't have to wait for tragedy to come do that. That's a very painful way to do it. You can be more consciously aware and selective about what you're putting on your plate, about what you're carrying around on you. And every extra time you let go of something that is not bringing you joy, you now have new space that's been created. And it doesn't mean the very next thing you try is going to be the one. But if you do that process and you're willing to do that work of going through those 1,000 different combinations, you'll find the light bulb. And what's happened to me is I've been doing this process for so long. My life is filled with things that bring me joy, filled. And that didn't happen overnight. It's not some overnight kind of process. It's long and it's slow and it's agonizing sometimes, you know? And I am still regularly, I mean, even this morning, you know, I was in a deep struggle, deep internal struggle in myself, working with something that I've been working with for so long. And I have to keep reminding myself, you know, it's patient step by step, you know, that moves you through the long journey.
I want to say one little thing about that, and then I have a question to ask you, and then we'll move into the end of the interview, even though we could go on easily,
sure.
Not just for hours, we could for days. But it just reminds me of, I was sharing with my husband recently. So I'm 47. And I said, I have fallen in love with the aging process because.
Beautiful.
Yeah. Because what I love about aging is that life grows you. So the more you get to live, the more you get to grow. Yes. And just like what you're saying, you can speed the growth along with, you know, with all the things that we do, with the books that we do and the practices that we have. And there is just some element of, you just need to live, like have like day after day, there's yes. growth in that. And it's just what you're saying about, yeah, you joy living a life that makes you come fully alive. It's day after day after day, and you can speed it up.
It's work.
You know, day after day after day. And there's yes. actually, that in itself is a beautiful thing. Because I don't know that we would want it just handed to us. Because
we wouldn't. We'd be bored with it.
Right. Yeah. That's right.
We'd be bored. My you know, mentor, this guy named Jerry, he's a super special guy. He's quite irreverent. And one of the things he said about the way the classic view of heaven, the way they describe it, you know, where it's like the grass is always green, it's always, you know, nothing bad ever happens, it's always just sunny and everyone's just having barbecues all day or whatever. He said, people would hate that kind of heaven, oh, you know,
totally.
Like they would, he said there would be mass suicide. Mass suicides after not very long. He said, that's what people think that they want, you know. But once you have it, you know, there's only, you know, so long that you can be inside of that, where it's really the experience of growth,
right.
You know, is the thing that makes us come alive, you know, the most, and movement and change and all of that. So these very static ideas we have, you know, just really don't serve us.
I agree. Okay, so I have one question here that's a little bit of a tangent, and then I'm going to bring the interview to a close with
sure.
a few things and one last question. But I have to ask this because I've never heard anyone answer this way. And I was really intrigued. One of the questions that I send out is about turning points. And you talked about a few different turning points in your life. And then you said, but I have turning points all the time. I had one, a major turning point this morning. And I thought, wow, what? Okay, either you're like, the way you see turning points is different, or you're living life in such a way that you have this openness, this like awareness to things changing. It's just like, what does that even mean? How are you viewing turning points, and how are you living that they're happening so frequently?
God, that is a really, you know, it's another question we could really do a whole nother
few
hours on, but I can definitely, several things come to mind about that. One is, you know, in a lot of the work that I do, what's often attributed to it, you know, is people say it was life-changing. I think that's great, but it's also kind of funny because life should be changing all of the time, you know, and the idea that we use this term life-changing to indicate the rarity of something, I think is just telling us how much of our life is pattern and static and not actually what I would consider life. So if you have like a plant, for instance, and we came from plants, it's important to remember, you know, so we still have those aspects in us. When I say we came from plants, I mean a long, long time ago.
Yeah.
But if a plant had an Instagram, you know, every day it would be like #life changing, because every day they're changing and they're growing based on one thing and one thing only. And that is where the nutrients are, where the light is. What do they need to grow? They're only obsessed with what they need to grow. And that is a basic principle of life. That humans, we have had the ability to somehow disconnect from, you know, and our ability to leave some of our old instincts has been very powerful in some ways, and it's been devastating in other ways, you know. So I do live a life where I'm constantly experiencing change, and I wasn't being facetious when I said that. I do have small turning points frequently, but lately I've been having more and more large turning points. And the big turning point that I was referencing then had to do with what I've been talking to you about, which is a kind of a whole another deep thing about the power of conversation. And I think just to succinctly say it, first I would say that joy is very connected with growth, as I've been saying the whole time. And one of the reasons that I know that is when you have an epiphany, even the word ecstasy, it comes from the word ecstatic, which in the Greek basically means to leave oneself. And so if you're leaving oneself, you expand. You know, and Einstein says, you know, a mind that expands never returns to its original size. And the whole idea of the ecstatic experience and ecstasy, it was originally, you know, a mystical religious experience where people would be in conversation with God, you know, and they would have realizations and epiphanies. But the interesting thing to me is when you have an epiphany, when you realize something that you didn't realize, when you solve a problem you've been working on for a while, how does that feel? It feels joyful every single time. So people that aren't having enough joy in their life, it's because they're not having enough epiphanies. And if you're not having enough epiphanies, it's because you're not having enough joy. Those two things are so connected. So the more and more that I'm in the joyful state, I have epiphanies often and frequently. And because I have designed my life, you know, to not be too attached to any specific form, it's designed to be flexible so that when I get new insights, I can just go with it. I can just move, you know. And the epiphanies that I've been having recently have been deeply connected with what the body really is and what the body is capable of as an incredible artistic, you know, instrument. It's kind of funny how people will say, oh, I'm not creative. And it's like, well, you have three children. And it's like, yes, you know, but I'm not an artist. You know, it's like your body made three humans from a bunch of apples and oatmeal and whatever else you ate. Your bodies are massively creative, you know? So when we say, I'm not creative, we're talking about this very thin sliver of one aspect of our personality that doesn't happen to measure up to the person who has an Instagram following of 500,000. It's like, that is such a thin, you know, small sliver to mistake yourself for when you're really the size of infinity, when your body has the intelligence in it that is constantly reshaping itself and reimagining itself and is even capable of duplicating and creating new versions of itself that are fractals of you. I mean, it's just stunning. So I've been diving really deeply into exploring different levels of conversation with different aspects of myself. And it's been opening up worlds inside of me, you know, just to say it all, I guess that thing we were talking about earlier is relationship with self. I've really been looking at practically what relationship with self looks like and feels like and means. And I've been spending a lot of time there.
What you just said, actually, you just gave me an epiphany, or I had an epiphany in what you said, because I realized that interviews like this, for me, that's what they are, conversations with God. Like that.
Exactly.
Yeah. And yeah. So that, okay. So.
Well, because you said that, let me just throw in one extra thing. I wasn't going to say this, but I think that's a sign to me I need to say this. And that is, I had probably one of the most important moments of my life in Paris this summer where I was living. And I was going through a very hard time. And I won't tell you all of the events that happened because it would take too long, but some pretty wild things happened. And of a life where I've lived many, many profound experiences and many incredible moments of epiphany and joy, I would say three of the biggest, most profound moments I've ever had in my life happened this summer. And all three of them I was completely alone for. And that was quite stunning to me because, you know, usually there other people are involved. But what I basically ended up realizing is that when we say we've grown, what we really mean is that we see things differently, because we don't mean we physically grown. You know, when somebody says, oh, I've grown so much over the last 3 years, it means that they see the same things that were in their life, the same choices, the same opportunities, they see them differently. So now when they meet those things, they will have different responses as potential available choices to them. And then because they see those new options, they are more likely to take one of those options. And then the whole situation ends up differently. So when we say we've grown, it just means that we see things differently. And the only way that we ever see anything differently is through conversation. That's how changes in perception happen. It's only through conversation. Sometimes that's conversation with friends, sometimes with authors, you know, in books, sometimes with a painting or some other form of art, sometimes with God, you know, or whatever your version of that is. But it's in conversation that we change. It's in conversation that we grow. And what I love so much about that is every human on the planet, no matter how rich you are, no matter how many followers you have or how talented you think you are capable of having a conversation that can change the way that you see something and change the way somebody else sees something. And to me, there's something so beautiful and equalizing about that, that is so powerful. And a lot of my art projects right now are around, you know, raising the awareness of how important and powerful conversations are and the impact that they can have, and how that, you know, this whole hierarchy, you know, of these artists that get raised up on these pedestals like gods, you know, that's the old model. The new model that's coming in is going to be a deep awareness that every single human has an incredible amount of value to give, you know, and more will be taught and learned about how to create spaces where people can grow into that. Because for all of our achievements we've done, if we're honest with ourselves as a species, it's an incredibly small percentage of us that have actually contributed to those major achievements. And if we could just up that number by 1% or 3% or 5% of people contributing on that level, we would be able to solve such incredible, you know, problems. We would be able to build such stunningly beautiful things that is far beyond what we've even come close to imagining yet, with just a small percentage shift, you know? And all of that incredible possibility comes back down practically to people having real conversations and sharing real things that happen to them in ways that cause shifts in perception, you know? And the fact that even just through one conversation, it's 10 minutes or 30 minutes or an hour, you can walk away and see things differently after that, that's amazing. That's absolutely amazing. And the fact that one person didn't lose their opinion to give it to you, they shared their perception, and now you both have it. And now those perceptions, like Steve Jobs said, mix with other perceptions, and then new, you know, connections happen. That's what creativity is. So a conversation exemplifies the very root of the most beautiful aspect of what creativity is, and not in some highbrow artistic way of, this is a cow hanging from a violin string, you know, and that's art. It's like, no, like a real, this made an impact in my life kind of art, you know, and we're all capable of that. We all have that birthright in us. And I think it's so exciting to be alive right now, because we're coming into a time where more people than at any time in history, a higher percentage than at any time in history, are going to have access to that. And as they start opening and contributing, we're going to see things shift and change in just the most magnificent ways.
Okay, so that is a perfect place to come to a close. And the way that I do this is a few things. First, I want to let folks know where to find you. So one way is Instagram, which is at Jesh Derox. So it's J-E-S-H-D-E-R-O-X. And then the best website that you mentioned, Jesh, is kindred.com. So it's K-I-N.
Right.
All the way through to kindred.com. And that is, say what that is?
Those are creative retreats that basically explore how to build a relationship with the self in really fun, beautiful, powerful ways. And I also didn't know that this was had a business context, actually. So for people that are interested in that, this course that I have, Business as an Art Form, is businessasanartform.com. So that would be where to find that.
Great. Excellent. And then the next piece before I ask the last question is gratitude. And for me, when things feel true to me, so not truth, but when they are just true for me, I often will tear up a little. There have been times when tears were running down my cheeks listening in this conversation. Like there were so many moments where I was just moved by what you said.
Beautiful.
And it opened up so many openings. And what I'm grateful for with you is how much you have devoted your life to the conversation between yourself, between others, between ideas, and just this being in relationship, in conversation with the world. It has led to such a depth in who you are and a richness in the conversations that you help facilitate and that someone has when they enter into conversation with you. And so I'm really grateful for that dedication that you have.
Thank you.
To yourself.
Thank you. Yeah.
And then the last question, I always wonder what I want the last question to be. It's changed many, many times. And I think in this case, I would just say, if there's anything that has not been said that you want to speak into the space right now, to share that.
Yeah, the thing that comes to me actually is, I feel that there are particular people that are going to be listening to this that have just been way, way, way too hard on themselves and are holding, you know, deep incriminations and long-term judgments on themselves for things that have absolutely nothing to do with their fault. A lot of what we deal with in life is just avalanched down, you know, from thousands and thousands of years of genetics, you know, that we're working with, of people who did their best, you know, and they survived. But they came to the finish line, you know, bloody and broken and scared and terrified, you know, and that stuff lives in our genes. And so, you know, of many beautiful things that happened this summer to me, one of the most beautiful, you know, was I was having this moment of kind of self-doubt and, you know, being super hard on myself about this one particular area where I was struggling. And I just kind of heard, you know, this voice kind of just say, you know what, that's yours, but it's not you. And the difference between yours and you is super, super important. Some of these issues that you're facing, some of the things that are, you know, in your personality, they're yours because they're a part of your body. They're inside of you right now. And so yours means that you have the responsibility for them and you have the agency to be able to change them. But that change is going to be a process. It's not going to be an overnight thing, but they are not you. And it's so, so, so important to not identify with those problems, to not say, I am like this, I am like this, I am like this. Because when you identify with the problems and issues that you have, you create this terrible conflict inside yourself where a part of your biology, whose job it is, the survival mechanism, is only to protect you. It's only to keep you safe. And so when you identify with these big problems and issues you're facing, you actually assign a part of your body to protect that from changing. And so people go through these terrible, tearing places in their heart and in their life and in their mind where they can't seem to change. They can't seem to let go of these specific behaviors. And even though they've caused so much damage to them, and even though they've just sucked them dry and left them bleeding and broken, and it's because, you know, some part of the biology is identified with those things. And a person has to do this work to start understanding what is you, what is yours, and what is not yours. And if a person can just get clear on those three things, what's you, what's yours, and what is not yours, so much of the complexity and the tangle, you know, of life that just keeps drawing us like a whirlpool back into, you know, self-loathing and destructive tendencies. And, you know, even when it's not as intense as all that, it's just in any given moment, we could be feeling beautiful. We could be telling somebody else that they're beautiful. We could be laughing, you know, we could be singing, we could be jumping. And, you know, kids are in that state so much until they start growing up and all of this stuff that's sifting through us kind of comes back. And to be an adult, I think, is to face all of that stuff, you know, and to do it gracefully and gently and know that no matter what you are as an artist, no matter what your form is, you are your work. Your life is going to be your work more than anything else. And so just know this is not a short thing. It's a long thing. Be patient and gentle in that process. And know that even from the darkest, heaviest, ugliest things that we were past, those too can be transformed. Those too can be changed. And changing something dark that's been handed to you into something beautiful, into a reason for joy, is, I think, the most powerful of all artistic practices. And so I would just really encourage you as the listeners to be slow and gentle and give yourself so much patience with this process and really just practice enjoying the journey of it, because this is it. This is it right here.
Thank you so much, Jesh.
So welcome. Thank you for having me.
I'm Daphne Cohn, and you've been listening to the Creativity Habit Podcast. For more conversations with brave and experimental artists, and to learn more about the collective, head on over to thecreativityhabit.com. You can follow The Creativity Habit on Instagram, and you can support the podcast and the artists on it by going to iTunes Podcasts and subscribing, rating, and reviewing this podcast. Now, to review, you actually have to get on your laptop and subscribe to the podcast, and it does take a few minutes. But the more reviews, the more folks know about all these incredible artists and makers doing such beautiful work in the world. So thank you for taking a little bit of your time to share your thoughts over at iTunes. Thank you for listening.